everyone, this is Scott Spinelli, and you are listening to episode 15 of I'm Sure I'm Overthinking This. This week's guest is Tyler Gilden, executive producer at Elite Daily and stand-up comedian. Tyler's in charge of a ton of the video content over there at Elite Daily. And if you remember Elite Daily from a while ago, sort of like a chauvinistic bro-y type website, and haven't been there in a while, I'm not just saying this because I'm friendly with Tyler. I say this on the interview and I mean it sincerely. It really has changed. It's actually a really quality site producing some very funny videos. In fact, some videos. I know they did a video about a whole documentary series on what's going on in Flint, Michigan with the water crisis, obviously. So at any rate, it's a much different site than you might remember it as, so give it a look. But anyway, this is the last episode of what I'm sort of just making up as a season here. 15 episodes sound like a round number, so that's where we're going to end it for right now. Take about a 3 to 4 month break and then come back. Why the break, you might be wondering? Because it's only once a week and it really doesn't seem like that much. Well, first of all, it is taking a little bit more of my time than I originally anticipated. But secondly, I'm trying to finish the first draft of my second book that I'm working on right now. Hopefully, that will allow me some time also to get some other writing projects off the ground as well. But anyway, before we get to the interview with Tyler, I just want to say thank you so much to everyone for reaching out and for helping with this. First of all, to the guests who have come on over the last 15 weeks. And then additionally, and more importantly, to the people who have listened and just had nice things to say. I mean, I don't know if I've responded to every single one of you, but it makes my day. You know, you get a really nice email or a tweet or whatever, and it sort of validates the fact that you're not just doing this alone and somebody actually is listening. So I won't rattle on too much longer. Thank you so much for all that. We'll be back in a couple of months. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Tyler Gilden. All right, so the first thing I need to ask you as someone, you're the first person I've had on here that I actually consider funny, is when did you first realize that you were a funny person?
Wow, that's a big compliment. Or maybe you just need to do a better job of bringing in guests. The first time, I don't know, that's kind of a tough question. I guess I was just always interested in performing. And I always used to, you know, write jokes. I mean, I'm sure they were awful, but I when I was younger, had a notepad where I used to write some like observations down. But I don't know if there's like a trigger moment per se. I guess, I kind of just was always into it. And I mean, I used to do a lot at like, a Rosh Hashanah or a Hanukkah dinner. I used to do like, you know, little skits with my cousins. And I guess I kind of, you know, kept running with that.
Well, did you, I guess the better way to phrase it is, did you always feel that innate thing of like, well, what I have to say is funnier than what my friends have to say, so I'm going to be the one that speaks up and says the funny thing here? Or did you sort of lay in the cut more and not, and sort of was more of the shyer comedic personality growing up?
I mean, I was definitely never, I mean, shy was never, I mean, I don't think anybody who's ever met me would use shy to possibly describe me. So if anything, I was like obnoxiously outspoken in many ways where I probably thought I was a lot funnier than I actually was. I'll probably say that much. I think it's at some point it finally caught up where like people were like, okay, he's, you know, mildly as funny as he thinks he is. But I think at first I was just really more of a, you know, loudmouth ADD kid who I think drove every teacher growing up just insane. Now, if my mom, who just literally, I was at her retirement party last week, she worked in my school district, in my middle school, but had she not been in my district and I didn't get like, you know, treated differently because people knew my mom, like I probably would have been thrown out of a lot more classes.
I had a similar issue where I just, every report card, like the grades were good, but the comment section was the exact same, like talks too much, disruptive in class, the same.
Oh yeah.
It was just a carbon copy, every single marking period semester.
That's so funny because it reminds me, in high school, I got the three Ds. It was disrespectful, disruptive, and distracts others from learning. Those were the three Ds.
Yeah.
I got in like my 10th grade global studies class, Miss Babish, that's what she gave me. But I had A's. Like I had A's in academics, but I had D's in terms of just like being an appropriate child in a classroom.
At what point did you transition from... Because I feel like a lot of people that have a sense of humor are just, and more often than not, obviously, are content to just be the funny person in their group of friends. When did you, because you and I met doing stand-up at Syracuse University, when did you or how did you come to decide, you know what, maybe I should give this a try? Because obviously it's a leap. Like, there's one thing to be funny in front of 5, 10, 15, 20 people, but then to go up there and put your personal stuff out there for everybody, even if the jokes aren't that personal, that's a big leap. So how did you come to make that leap?
You know, I'd probably say, thinking about it, I think, you know, and I would actually credit summer camp for a lot of this. You know, I went to, you know, typical Jewish summer camp where, you know, you go away for 8 weeks, but as you get older, it's like 6 weeks, but it costs double the price because that's just the way somehow the economics have changed, where it was like 8 weeks for one price, now it's 6 weeks for double that original price.
Yeah.
But I used to always do, you know, either like the talent shows, or we would do like these like color war skits. And I really think doing that and just becoming a little bit more accustomed to speaking in large groups and, you know, attempting to be funny, it just kind of at a young age made me feel a little bit more naturally comfortable with it. And then in high school, they had this show called Cabaret Night that raised money for Sloan Kettering. And it was like this really big show they would do every year. And there was a comedy team, there was a musical team, there was a band, there was maybe a dance team. And I did that. And I made it my sophomore year, which was pretty rare for comedy. And I saw already, you know, in 10th grade, I already was still getting more opportunities to stand, you know, to be in front of people and be funny. But the first time I actually did stand up itself, I believe, was maybe my junior or senior year of high school in a talent show. But the confidence I had was through having done all those other, you know, shows and more of like sketch comedy stuff, that I finally said, you know, all right, let's give it a shot. And then obviously, as you know, through Syracuse, I mean, that was huge. Doing, you know, what was it? A Woohoo Comedy? I mean, those shows. Yeah, doing those shows sometimes for, you know, a lot of people or a little bit of people. I did so many shows in school that by the time I graduated, I didn't feel like I was fully already comfortable with standing and speaking in front of people. That, you know, that wasn't a problem for me anymore.
See, here's a very specific question that I feel like not everyone listening to this will be able to truly relate to. But did you, even though you could do stand-up comedy, did it still make you nervous to do like a book report in front of the class, or, you know, a report on you know, why Herbert Hoover was the worst American president, you know, something like that? Like, did you, because I don't know about you, but for me, like, I had no trouble, or not no trouble, but generally speaking, no trouble getting up, doing the show. There could be 10 people, there could be, you know, 100, 200, and I was generally all right. But if I had to do, I would always get the sweats, at least as a kid, doing stuff that I wasn't comfortable about in front of a class. Did you have that problem, or were you just, I gather you were fairly smooth in front of, or relatively smooth in front of all those situations?
No, but you're 100% right. I mean, there's a big difference between, you know, getting up and being you and, you know, telling jokes, opposed to, you know, giving a presentation on whatever the hell the science projects were that you'd give up and talk about, you know, mercury or whatever we would talk about. But what you're more comfortable with, you know, is you. So I think I was a lot better with like just calling out and asking questions in class than necessarily like presenting in class. But I actually, what I used to do when I started doing this in I think maybe like ninth grade, is I used to somehow get away with, instead of doing any class presentations, I would convince my teachers to let me make videos. So rather than like doing these big reports, a lot of times I kind of just made videos. Like, I remember I did one on Greek mythology, and I used like all my like figurines, and me and my friends in my basement like created all these things. That's how I used to avoid having to do some of these like in-class presentations, was creating videos, which not many people were doing then. So I think the teachers were like so happy that it was something different. And I felt like they kind of felt whenever I was up in front of the class speaking, I was usually inappropriate. So if they could screen the video first before it was aired, I think they felt a lot more comfortable.
So you, in addition to all those D's, you had a C, which was conniving as well, I take it.
I definitely had a conniving, strategic way of trying to turn every presentation into something that better suited my abilities or interests.
So with the stand-up, though, I mean, that obviously, I didn't know how early you had been doing it. That makes sense, because like I said, we met doing the stand-up, and when did you graduate again?
So I graduated in 2011.
Okay, so yeah, we met, and you started pretty early on, but you had a comfort level that was was obviously as high as most of the people that had been doing it. Like, I honestly, when I first met you, I wasn't sure what year you were, because of the fact that you seemed extremely comfortable, much like most of the people that have been doing it for a while there. Obviously, the talent level was very quite varying on some of those stages. But I think one thing that people don't know about stand-up comedy in college, and I'd like you to talk about this with me for a second here, is that it's really not at all similar to real-life comedy in that, you know, you go to New York, you have to work on the same bit all the time and improve it and get it better. But when you were in Syracuse, and I don't know if you felt this pressure, I knew that the same general group of people were coming to all these shows. You'd have your friends, you'd have the same people that were fans of the other people, and you'd have the same people that were just fans of the group in general. And so I didn't want to do the same shit every 2 weeks. You know, I wanted to come up with a new 10 minutes, which is almost ridiculous if you think about it, right? Like, writing a new 10 minutes is crazy. Did you feel that pressure, or were you okay with doing a lot of the same stuff?
Yeah, no, I mean, so the you know, it's kind of twofold. So when you have a good group of friends and a good group of support system that comes out and supports you, comes to their shows, they're in general, because as you said, it's very hard just to write another 10 minutes. It's, you know, hard enough just to write another 5 minutes. So a lot of times your friends will hear the same jokes. My friends, there was a point in time where, you know, my friends could literally recite my entire set, to the extent that I was like, I now hate all my jokes and all my friends because they won't stop, you know, sometimes yelling out my punchlines at my shows because they were just so used to them. So the key is obviously finding friends who are supportive and understand, like, listen, you know, there's other people in the audience besides you guys, and I know you heard this joke before, but, like, you know, watch how I, you know, tweak it this time, where, you know, some of my friends, they started telling me, instead of watching me, they were watching the audience because they felt like it was a new audience every time, but it was the same set, so they got to see, like, an audience's reaction. But it does challenge you to have to keep writing, so I did like that, too. So I agree, at Syracuse, especially when we had, like, a new monthly thing, I did try and at least do half and half, because, yeah, when you have the same people there, you do feel awkward if you're telling them the same jokes, but sometimes you have to kind of ignore your friends who are there. Like, you know, I started to, you know, at some point I liked having friends at shows because it was a good support system, but sometimes I also didn't like it because I also wanted to, A, see how I could, you know, do in a room where I didn't know anybody. There was no preconceived, you know, notions of who I was. So I think there's pros and cons, but the plus is it does challenge you to want to create more jokes and write more often because you do feel like, hey, I don't want my friends to think I'm just, you know, plateauing here in my joke writing. You know, I still even today have friends who'd like, you know, if I'm coming doing a show, the first question is like, you got any new material? It's like, you know, fuck off. Like, do you want to come to a show or not? Like, it's a, you know, do you want to support me or do you want new material?
I used to love when people asked me that. It was so fucking insulting when someone would say, do you have any new material? It's like, no, I'm sorry, I'm only going to make you laugh at a nearly professional level for 15 minutes with stuff you've heard. I'm sorry. Next time I'll write brand new hour for you.
No, I literally have friends who still ask me. The dumb questions are like, got any material, or like, don't make fun of me. And it's like, I'm like, it's delighted that you really think that you're that high on yourself that you think I'm going to go to a show, you know, in New York City and just call out you, my friend, and just like, you know, pick on you. So I love that. Like, don't make fun of me. And do you have any material? And then the other thing is when I'm at a show and when my friends text me, like, what time are you on? Like, dude, fuck off. Like, I'm already, like, sweating in the back of anxiety, getting ready to get on. Like, I don't need to, like, appease your timetable. You came to the show, you came to the show. But in all fairness, some shows in the city, depending on what show you're on, can be relatively long. So I do appreciate when people come out, you know, on a weeknight for, you know, several hours. But that's why I just stopped inviting my friends.
So I agree with everything you're saying. All three of those things annoy, I don't really do it anymore, but when I used to do stand-up, all three of those things annoyed the hell out of me. I mean, I don't think people take it as, understand how much work it is. Like, this idea that you're just casually waiting around and can inform everyone, oh, I'm going on at this exact time. Like, you don't have anything else to worry about. Or the idea that, like you said, and the second thing is the one that really pisses me off, when people say, like, don't use me in your act. I mean, can you possibly get over yourself? Is there any way for you to, because the person that says that, right? I don't know about in your experience, but in my experience, the person who says that is almost exclusively the person that you're like, we're not even, where do you think you rank in my life that I would even consider? I'm only inviting you because I need to have bodies here. Like, I don't even know why. I don't know. For me, that was always the case.
So spot on. It's usually some girl who, like, was just like an add-on of an add-on, and like, she's the one who has to make that comment because she feels like, for some reason, you know, she thinks so highly of herself that, yeah, I'm gonna st- stop halfway through and just like focus on you. And yeah, so that's so funny because yeah, it's never like one of your close buddies. It's usually someone like who's fairly one, if not 2 degrees separated from you, but you appreciate them coming and supporting you, but it's like, yeah, just support me and sit in the back and just laugh. And that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'd rather them tell me that I was awful than give me all that pre-show grief. Like I remember once I had a girl, who thought it was free. She was upset that I didn't have free tickets for her. I was like, this is not what this is. And I mean, at any point, like these things cost money and I'm ready to go on stage. And now I've got to deal with the fact that this girl that I'm dating is throwing a fit to me that I don't have free tickets for her and her friends. Like, you know what I mean? Like I would never do that before you went to work. And I granted, like I'm not getting paid, but you get the idea.
No, yeah, I mean, I definitely have people ask for like, yo, man, can I get like a free table for this? It's like, yeah, dude, no, you could come and you could laugh and you could enjoy it. But of course, you know, the 2-drink minimum, obviously some people get a little tight about that. But I've had times before where like I really felt like I did so bad that I've, you know, if I had friends there, I just covered their whole table because I was just like, so, you know, when I'm just like really like, wow, I stunk and you guys had to pay $40-$50 for that. I'm sorry. I've done that a couple of times at Impulse, which like was pretty dumb on my part. Like, why did I just need to like lose a couple $100 doing a show? Like I lost confidence and money. But sometimes I do understand, it can be expensive in the city because it's for a lot of these clubs, it's a liquor business. But, you know, that's why sometimes you're going to go to bar shows and a lot more low key like lounges. I found sometimes my friends enjoyed that more, even though it wasn't necessarily the same, prestige, feeling of being at like a big club. But, the idea that they didn't have to spend money, even though they spent it anyway on liquor. But when you tell someone they have to spend it, sometimes people get a little tight.
Now, you mentioned something before we got into the things we hate about people who come to our shows or your shows, I should say. And it was basically the idea that like there's a certain calculus to how jokes are constructed. You know, you were saying how sometimes just listen for how I tweak it and what I do. I'll give you an example, and I'm sure I've told this story before on this podcast, but I'm not sure anybody listens in the first fucking place, so here it goes. The story was basically I did a joke once about how my grandmother jokingly after describing to her that and I'm basically telling you this story so you have time to think of an example of your own. The situation was that I said something to the effect of like, I don't really like any of the girls I'm dating. And my grandmother said, just admit it already, you're gay. Right. And so then I said to her, I think I said, go fuck yourself, grandma, or something like that. Right. And people laughed. And then I listened to it afterwards and I thought, let me see if the part that people are laughing at is the fuck. You know, that might be the actual part that people are laughing at. And as it turns out, I took that out, did the same joke without the fuck, and it didn't get as big of a laugh. Now, I might not have delivered it as well, and, there's obviously a number of factors into it. But it really keyed me into this idea that it's truly like math in a way, where one thing gets taken out of the equation, and it's not quite the same joke. I was wondering if you have any examples or stories or situations where you've tinkered with jokes that just, wow, one word really makes a difference, or one little bit, one change, one tinker here or there.
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah, that's 100% accurate. Well, that's the thing that's so interesting, yet so frustrating, about comedies. You could have all the same jokes, but, depending on, how you deliver them, it's totally, it could be night and day, just depending on, well, there's so many factors that go into it. It also could depend on, who's in the audience, what your confidence level is, and if you say it with confidence, or if you say it, not being confident in yourself, it can make an impact. But I've done that several times with jokes where I'm like, yeah, if I just tweak this one word, would this change it? And sometimes I've been like, wow, that got a lot better. And sometimes I've been like, wow, that got, a lot shittier. So I think, it's people are sitting there and they're listening and, they are listening to the words you say because, the words you say determine the jokes you make. And, if you alter a punchline or a setup, it's totally going to have an impact on it. I've fumbled through, jokes sometimes, and it's like, it could be one of my better jokes, but if I fumbled through it and for some reason forgot a word or slurred something or, had to take a sip of water mid-joke because I had such dry mouth, like it totally can impact the outcome. Having to do some, if you have to improvise a bit in the middle of it can impact it. I've had a lot of times also, though, where, I've done a joke, and I even may have done a joke for a long time, but for some reason, something came to me and I just, whether it was off of reading the crowd or for some reason I improvised the line and it really worked, then all of a sudden that becomes part of the routine moving forward, where like it really was improvised the first time, but then moving forward, you know, it's, you know, intentionally part of the joke. So I do feel like even jokes that I've done for, you know, quite some time, you could always still enhance them and build on them. It's just a matter of sometimes just like taking the time and either rewatching, you know, re-listening, or just, you know, spur of the moment, something comes out and you're like, oh, wow, that's actually significantly better than I've ever done it before. Or you try something new and you're like, wow, let's not, you know, mess with something that works.
Let's talk about your process a little bit. Are you a guy who writes out your material? Do you do it on your iPhone? Where do you, and if you have an idea similarly, are you writing it down? Are you putting it in an iPad? Are you when you do your sets, do you do a full, you write everything out word for word? Are you like jotting outlines? Talk me through the process of how you put together a set like that.
So, yeah, I mean, my biggest flaw right now is I'm not writing right now. I mean, work has kind of consumed me, and, you know, so right now my answer would be different. But like when I was a lot more in the grind, yeah, I mean, the first time I would try and write it out, I was always pretty much, you know, on a computer guy. You know, I had a giant doc, you know, stand up, and I would just literally just write and write and write. And I use my notepad, and if something funny comes to me during the day, I put it in my notepad, on my phone notepad, not, you know, not written. I have awful handwriting. So my issue is if I do write down some jokes, and sometimes, like, I've done that before, and then, you know, I have no idea what the fuck it says anymore, because I have awful handwriting. I mean, I used to get, you know, teachers used to give me copies of the notes. Like, I was, like certified to get notes in classes. But anyway, so I do try and type it out as much as I can. But then, yeah, then it's playing around with it. For my sets now, no, I don't write them all out. Now, for the most part, I'd say, you know, whenever I get up, I'm doing very few new stuff. Most stuff is stuff that I've done already that I already know for the most part works, and maybe there's a tweak or two. Or sometimes I'll just, you know, if I do write up a set list, the jokes that I know are set in stone, I just have a key word that, you know, just a word that I know, like, is that joke. And if there is a new one, maybe I'll write that one out. And then when I go to the show, usually I email to myself or I put it fully in a notepad. So before I could review it, but for the most part, like, I'll run through it with one key word from every joke that I know. And that's how I'll remember the order, because I know it goes from, you know, James Franco to, you know, acid reflux to, you know, iPod. You know, I usually have like a key line that I know, and then that's how I'll like remember it all together. But, you know, unless when I'm first originally writing it, I don't, you know, necessarily type it all out.
Now, how about hecklers? How do you deal with hecklers?
How do I deal with hecklers?
Yeah, there's so many strategies, right? I mean, like, I know I personally, not that I had many, because I didn't do it for long enough, and I wasn't really an audience involvement type guy, but my general theory on it was I didn't want to involve the audience because I wasn't arrogant enough to think, or bold enough, I should say, not arrogant, but bold enough to think that I was the funniest person in the room. And, you know, I'm the only one with a microphone. I didn't want to give anybody an opportunity to even possibly upstage me. I realized that if you're confident in it, it can work the other way. What was your strategy for dealing with people that are talking?
I mean, I like crowd work. So, you know, I haven't as of recent, but, you know, for a while, the last 2 years, I was doing a lot of hosting. So I actually, you know, I like the kind of like quick off the cuff, ability to, you know, riff with audience. So I do enjoy that. In terms of like heckling, I've only been like really, really heckled. Like, actually a decent handful of times. You know, I've had people, you know, once or twice have to get like escorted out, or, you know, I've stormed off. You know, I didn't storm off the stage in the middle of the set, but at the end of it, I've stormed off and, you know, kind of said to the person running the show, like, yo, this person in the front is impossible. They're really screwing with me. And it's only really frustrating when, it's always frustrating, but if you're like, for that reason, like trying to record a set, like a DVD, like I've had times where, like, you know, I was specifically trying to record a DVD set, that I wanted to send around, and someone was heckling me. So that pissed me off. But I thought my worst heckling story, surprisingly, was actually from someone I freaking knew.
What?
When I did, when I did a couple of years ago, I did Caroline's, breakout comedy thing, and I did like a 35-minute set. It was pretty much like post college, and when I was really in the thick of doing so much, and I had so much material anyway, and, you know, I just graduated college, so like all my friends, you know, you were still friends with everybody, so like I was able to like pack the house with like a, you know, a couple hundred people, and in the front row there was just a girl from school, and she just was way, you know, she was just, you know, way too drunk, or God knows what she was on, and she she like called out several times. And it got to a point where like, you make a quick joke. I think, yeah, have another drink, whatever. But then it got to a point where it was like really bad that, you know, other people, my friends in the room were getting really frustrated with her because everyone knew who she was. And she eventually, you know, someone who was sitting with her kind of like walked her out, felt super embarrassed, but she totally threw me off my game. Like I totally had to like stop and be like, what was I up to? Like I was not able to play it off like that cool. Cause I was also personally frustrated as well. Cause I knew who the person was. And I'll tell you right now, I literally have no relationship with that person anymore. And nor do my friends. My friends to this day still don't like her because they were like, I still can't believe what she did at your show. So it's, it's remarkable when people get drunk at shows, for some reason, they just feel this, ability and just, yearning to scream out at you. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, I've done a decent job of handling, but yeah, I mean, sometimes people are just, people are just assholes sometimes and, they want to steal the show. So I think I try not to get very angry and agitated. I find sometimes when people get very angry and agitated, unless you can really roll with it, which some people are very good and really can, and they can, get the whole audience on their side. But it also depends too. Like I've been at a show where the person was, obnoxious to everybody and the audience hated them. Then it's actually easy, for the comic to kind of jump on that person because the whole audience will jump on them as well. And sometimes, I've had people, they get escorted out and everybody kind of claps because, they're just, when you're being a dick all night, the audience, they pay to come there too. They don't want that person there either. So when the audience is on your side, it does make it easier to, really be able to jump on that person.
Yeah, I think to go to that girl that you were talking about, I think those type of people are the same type of people that talk in the movie theaters. They somehow think that this is like a two-way experience, and it really isn't. I don't understand. Maybe it's just because I've done it, right? I'm not particularly polite, so I can't be that. Like, I don't understand why it is that because you're at this event, you think that you can now, like, it's a one-way conversation in the same way that a movie is a one-way conversation. You're not a part of it, really. Like, so I just never can understand that desire, drunk or not, to insert yourself into this person's show. And I'm good for you that you're not friends with that person. Fuck her. Like, it's not even.
Afterwards, I was like, yeah, no, it's pretty quiet for her. I was definitely like, you are huge piece of shit who totally threw me off my game in front of like several hundred people who came out to see me, and I hate you. But I do feel like, to be honest, it's a one-way street in terms of jokes, but it is a two-way in terms of we do rely on them for laughter. So like the difference in a movie is it's solely like the movie's gonna play regardless, if we're in the room or not, it's on a screen, these actors don't know. But with comedy, it does, the audience is huge. So I do look at it as a two-way street in terms of like, the entertainment and the factor of, as a comedian, I really, I get, motivated and driven off of crowd energy. So like when there is a crowd with low energy, it's tough to really come up to the, it's up to, the comedian to really bring them up. And I think that's why people liked when I hosted, is because just, my style is very fast talking. It's, very animated. It's a lot of energy. So people liked when I hosted because ideally I, was able to get the crowd, going. I've seen some hosts who are a lot dry humor, and don't get me wrong, there's plenty of hosts that are very good who are dry humor, but then it becomes a lot more Otis is on the first comedian to really get the crowd going. So I think people liked when I hosted or went first because I was good at biting a bullet because I just had a lot of energy and I could kind of suck some of the initial awkwardness out of the room when a show first starts. But so yeah, it's just not a two-way street in terms of like you calling out punchlines. I mean, I've had, plenty of times where, I'm about to say a punchline and someone in the crowd, yells it out and tries to guess it. And in that case, if they do guess it, it's probably not that good of a joke because the crowd seems to be able to guess your punchline. So sometimes it's like, okay, fair enough. I need to come up with a clever ending. But sometimes it's like, no, actually it's this. And thanks, asshole, for trying to step on my toes. This is why, I'm here and, why you're there.
Now, is there anything subject-wise, material-wise that you won't touch? Or do you, is everyone and everything open if it's funny?
I don't know. I mean, I think anything that's funny is, is funny. I'm not, I used to be a lot more of a sexual, edgy person. Not person, just in comedy. I'm still sexually edgy and sexual as a person, but as in performing. Then I tried to start doing more cleaner stuff for a period of time because it was like, hey, if you want to get on like one of these shows, like you got to be clean. But no, I don't think there's anything like I won't go there. It's more of like do I have something funny to say? Like, if I have nothing funny to say, I don't, like, you know, sometimes, you know, younger, inexperienced comedians make this mistake where they just think if they talk about something that's funny, it's automatically funny. But, like, if you don't have a joke or, like, an opinion or something you can actually say, just, you know, stating the obvious of a funny situation isn't necessarily telling a joke. You know, there's a difference there. So, I mean, if I have something funny to say about something, I'll do it. But I don't just, like, bring up something for the sake of it just to feel, like, you know, topical or, you know, edgy. I really, if there's no concrete joke there, then I, you know, then there's no reason for me to say anything.
So you mentioned young comedians, and also I believe we talked about bringer shows earlier. Just a quick word of advice on you, from you, who obviously has found success in the comedy world in a bunch of ways, and we'll get into what you're doing with Elite Daily in a minute here. But what would you suggest? I mean, you're a young comedian getting out there in New York. Is the bringer circuit still the way to go, or is there a better way?
I mean, it's hard to say. And you know, I do want to, you know, be frank. Like, I'm just, like, in terms of me being, like, an active comedian, you know, I've definitely dwindled down. I mean, I still, like I said, I'll get up a couple times a month, but it's mostly on produced shows. I'm not running to mics. I'm not hustling, you know, from show to show. You know, it's more on, like, hey, when I know people who are, you know, producing shows at clubs, I'm more likely to jump on those. Or the occasional, like, you know, private events. But, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to get into it. Like, it's, you know, I don't want to sound like the, you know, authority on it, because there are. I mean, there's some people who take the route of they just get really comfortable at, like, one club with, like, one set of, you know, with, like, one certain booker, and that's where they, you know, that's their safety place, and they, you know, grow to be one of the top people there, and then they extend out. You know, there's some people who just do the open mic circuit. There's some people who will work at a club as, like, a bar back, or, you know, a waiter just to get their foot in the door, or just, like, a promoter. There's, you know, people who bark to get time. So there's so many different ways to do it. It really depends on whether or not, like, you're fully, if it's, like, your only full-time job and you're also relying on it for income, then, like, yeah, you need to try and work at that club to actually get paid, because you're not going to get paid performing. But I definitely think the bringer circuit, you know, is definitely a way to go. But it's also, there's no guarantee in anything. You know, I mean, that's the truth. Like, it is really nice that I have been seeing so many, you know, comedians that I have done, you know, several shows with, and they are doing big things. And, like, I really, you know, I'm not one of those people who gets, like, bitter and jealous. Like, I like when people who I consider to be good people and good comics get good things. And so, like, a lot of people have, you know, been making it and will continue to make it. But there's a lot more who don't, you know, make it. And technically, like, what is, quote unquote, making it? You might get one late night spot, but then, you know, there's no guarantee you're still going to be able to make a full-time income for the rest of the year on it. So I think because there's so many comics out there, I mean, you could throw a microphone just out in New York City and, you know, 20 comics will instantly pick it up and start telling jokes. I mean, there's that many people who call themselves quote unquote comedians, and a lot of them are hustling, whether they're good or not, you know, obviously, you know, is, you know, subjective, but I do think there's a lot of different ways to go about it, but I also think we're at a time now where, you know, look at something that I did, you know, look at my career and why I've shifted, where I think if you want to be in entertainment and you want to be creating content, I think you have to be unique. I found, you know, having a digital presence was very important. You know, I kind of, you know, I think some comedians, you know, are, you know, they get bitter about these people who went digital first, and because then they have all these followers, then they can go to comedy. I mean, I think, you know, I'd like to say I'm one of the people who was kind of balancing both. I was always kind of doing both. It is important to be well-rounded, and, you know, a lot of these managers, agents, they care how many followers you have, how many views do you have, you know, so there's a lot of untapped, really funny talent just in the clubs, and, you know, it's very, very competitive. So, you know, my advice is really people being versatile and understanding that there is, you know, obviously get up in the clubs a lot as much so you have, you know, that feeling of being comfortable on stage and being able to perform, and you have that, you know, presence in a room, but also, like, try and do some sketch comedy, you know, try and have a digital presence, like, try and work on all aspects, because you also never know what's going to stick. You know, you throw enough shit on the wall, you know, yeah, sure, you might get, you know, noticed for one thing that you didn't expect to be the thing that would bring you to the next level. So, I mean, for me, it's, you know, that's what Elite Daily has done for me, you know, so much to the extent that, you know, I'm not even really performing nearly as much anymore, because I just have, you know, really taken my career has kind of shifted in a way I never anticipated it to do. But, I mean, it's only because I was, you know, opportunistic and open-minded. So I think people need to be open-minded to, you know, we don't live necessarily in a world where if you want to do stand-up, then, like, you know, you can make it and you can just be a touring comedian all your life. I mean, it's hard to really make a living off that, but it also depends on like what type of living you're trying to make, you know? So I don't want to talk for other people who like, you know, if they can do that and that's all they want to do, then, you know, kudos to them. I was never like that. You know, I love doing stand up and I've always wanted to use it as a tool to continue to put content out there and continue to entertain, but I never felt like I needed to only do stand up. You know, that was never my, my, you know, goal.
You good?
Yeah.
No, I think, you know, you started off saying how you weren't an authority, but that's the idea, right? Is that there is no authority. And so it's just nice to hear for people that are, you know, starting out what someone who has taken a path, not the only path, but a path on the entertainment road, what they've done. So to go back to Elite Daily, which is our last set of questions here for you before, obviously, we let you go. I know you're busy at work or you're going to be busy shortly. With Elite Daily, let's talk about the process a little bit. So in terms of, you know, is there a writer's room, you know, for some of the ideas you had? I mean, as someone who at one point in the very, very distant past wrote some dog shit articles for Elite Daily, it is amazing to me to see how good the quality is on that website, because I must say to you, I kind of hated that website when it first started. I thought it was I really did. I thought it was juvenile and stupid and just it wasn't very good. But now the content that is being churned out, I think, is really fantastic. I mean, obviously, you're doing some serious stuff on the Flint water crisis, you know, what's going on in Flint, Michigan, I should say. Mm-hmm. And then you do, I mean, some of the videos I've watched, I have legitimately, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on with you, have made me laugh out loud. The video about Instagram, like the new restaurant in New York site, obviously, that is only and then there was another one about how Netflix keeps really unhappy couples together. That I loved. I mean, like, so my point is, like, it really has expanded its reach and it's, I think it's matured as well. When some of those ideas are being tossed around, I don't know how many of them those specifically you're doing or you're involved in or whatever, but how does it work? Does someone pitch them to you? Do you come up with an idea and have to run it by people? How does it work from inception of idea to I'm watching the video at home?
Right. So just, to back up a little, obviously, you know, so when we were both, you know, I guess contributing writers to, you know, Elite Daily, you know, 3+ years ago. Yeah, I mean, it was Elite Daily was a very different site than it is today. I think, you know, there's nobody who will argue with that, including the founders. I mean, it was definitely a little bit more of a, you know, male chauvinistic site. It was definitely very scrappy. I mean, you got to remember, it was started by, you know, a couple of guys who didn't necessarily have any journalism degrees or any media experience, just kind of looking for an outlet to, you know, vent about, you know, ex-girlfriends and cool stuff and kind of just like put a place out there for them to just put their thoughts. But obviously over time we've, you know, evolved and, you know, we've brought in strong, experienced people and kind of just developed out verticals, developed out our voice. And, you know, so I originally came on to, you know, run the humor section and built that up for a year. And then as I transitioned over to video, where now, you know, I run departments, I mean, so we now have about a 20-person original video team, about a 4 or 5 person branded team, and we have a 10-person team out in LA who works on the Elite Daily Show, which is our exclusive daily show on Verizon's Go 90 network. I mean, within the team, we have people who obviously, you know, have different skill sets and work on different things. So we have, you know, a documentary team, you know, that's our insights team, where they are focusing on, you know, uncovering these stories like Flint's, which was, you know, a fantastic piece. And, you know, we ended up doing, you know, 4 mini episode profiles as well, where, you know, we just, that was really just sending out, you know, our cinematographer and actually one of our news writers, actually, he wasn't even one of our producers. It was actually one of our, somebody on the editorial team who had sound, who had found the story and, you know, found the group of people and found, you know, Aaron, the main guy. And we went out there and did that. So, yeah, I mean, I have my guys working on documentaries and I have guys who are working on strictly social videos. These are just the visually compelling, you know, high graphic, you know, square shaped, snackable videos that are constantly popping up on timelines. You know, I have certain people working on those. And then, you know, I have certain people working on some of the more scripted stuff. So like the 2 episodes that you referenced are both part of Millennials in New York. That's the, you know, parody Facebook page, 2 of the writers on the editorial side had created about a year or so ago. They actually sold a book that's coming out in December. It's basically a parody of Humans in New York. And when we saw the success of the page, we said, hey, how would this work as a web series? So one of my, you know, producers slash creatives, as well with, you know, cinematographer and an editor, kind of said, let's develop this into a series. You know, we've done about 14 episodes to date. So those are the two, the Instagram and the Netflix one you're referencing are from there. So, I mean, for us, it's always been about, you know, versatile content. Everything, obviously, we want to be geared towards that, like, millennial experience. But ultimately, everything we make either has some sort of, you know, emotion, it's, you know, relationships, you know, aspiration, edge. Those are the things we're trying to look for. We're like, we want to evoke emotion in whatever we create. Like, if we just create something that just, you know, doesn't do much, then, you know, why? Who's going to share it? Who's going to comment? So, like, you know, a lot of controversial stuff we'll do. A lot of our documentaries have been on subjects, you know, when we did that Homeless Joe one, the homeless guy who...
Yep, I saw that one.
Women
yeah.
on the streets. Right. So, like, that was a great, like, controversial one. And you, either you loved them or you hated them. But either way, you had a feeling about them. No one watched it and said, oh, okay, yeah, that, you know, everyone was like, this guy's the man, or like, this guy's a piece of shit. But either way, you felt something, and that, you know, inspired you to want to, you know, comment and share it, you know, whether it was a share out of liking it or a share out of hating it. I mean, a share is a share. It's just, you know, putting it on people's timelines and recirculating it. So, yeah, I mean, for us, you know, the process is really, you know, my guys, so, you know, we have pitch meetings per team. It's not usually like a full team. It's usually within the documentaries or the scripted or the social. And I mean, I have also a lot of confidence in my guys. You know, my guys are pretty good. I have a great team. And for the most part, if they really want to do something and they could, you know, just prove why they want to do it, you know, like who the audience is, why they think it would do well, you know, what it compares to something else we've done, you know, as long as they can justify it and it's not some crazy cost, you know, yeah, we give it a shot.
So now, last question from me is, let's say I'm listening to this right now, and I think I'm hysterical. I'm a writer. I'm a aspiring improv guy. I'm a comedian of some kind. And I love the stuff that Elite Daily is doing. And I am listening to Tyler Gilden talk about this great work environment in New York and LA and things like verticals, which I can't even understand unless it's in the NBA. And I'm hearing you talk about all these things, and I want to work at Elite Daily. What is the thing that you are looking for in terms of if somebody sends you something, or I don't know, even I'm not saying you're necessarily soliciting, you know, you're welcoming these things, but
right.
When you're looking for a prospective employee or you're looking at something, what's something that Tyler Gilden, Elite Daily executive producer, is looking for in a prospective new person to add to his team?
I mean, right now it's just, you kind of have to be, you know, a little multifaceted. Like, we don't have anyone on my team who's just like, I just write. You know, we have like creatives who will like help write and direct slash produce, you know, or, you know, write and edit. Like, we have a lot of people, clearly everyone usually is, you know, their strength is in one thing, but they're also fairly good at doing something else. You know, we had the whole predator approach, you know, you could produce and edit, or, you know, you could shoot and produce. So I think right now, just because of the amount of content we make and the nature of the beast, the more skills you have, the better. Right now, it wouldn't necessarily make sense just to bring on a writer. Maybe for like a branded piece that we sold and all of our in-house guys are just slammed and we just needed to bring on like a freelance writer would make sense. But in terms of like full-time, I mean, the only full-time writers are usually on the editorial team who write articles all day. Some of those guys have definitely wrote scripts that we have definitely produced. You know, Millennials in New York originated from two of the humor writers, so they write articles all the time, and then they helped write along with, you know, one of my creative guys on my team write the scripts. But right now, we really only have on my whole team about two people who are consistently writing scripts. But then everything else is more either like social video where it's not really a script is needed, and or it's documentary where, you know, a script isn't needed. But, you know, we will occasionally fund outside projects. So if someone comes to me, you know, we had something called an artist residency where basically we worked with several filmmakers and basically funded them to do 4 or 5 episode series, due to just the recent changes of some things and just feeling like, because we have less control and sometimes we've approved something and ultimately the execution we felt wasn't up to our standards, we're not doing it as much. But if someone has a great piece of something and they're like, hey, I did this really good series, like, would you guys be interested? You know, we're always, you know, there's always also the conversation of, you know, acquiring existing content or licensing content. We've done that with people several times. We're like, if something's good, it's good. But, you know, it's hard, you know, on a good script, you know, unless we have time internally with everything we're doing that we could produce it, it's hard sometimes just to, you know, unless you've seen this person's work and you know that, you know, some people can write fantastic scripts, but they have absolutely no idea how to actually, like, produce something and put it together. So it's easier if you're, like, a writer-producer and you have more experience to show me. But, yeah, I mean, like, when people are applying for jobs, it's always like, what have you done so far? And if they've never created any digital video, it's hard to justify hiring someone to, you know, help create digital videos. Because, you know, it is a little bit of a different beast than necessarily, like, working in TV. But, you know, then again, like, we also have, you know, production assistants who kind of do a jack-of-all-trades and slowly, you know, build their way up to either being a fully editor or being fully a producer. So I think, you know, there is definitely a learning curve there. But in terms of just like, hey, I'm funny, you probably have maybe a better chance getting like a written job in editorial than just like, you know, we're not going to hire, at least not now, just a full scriptwriter. That person, like I said, has got to be, you know, scriptwriter slash proven director, scriptwriter slash proven producer, and had several pieces of work I've seen where I'm like, oh no, yeah, this guy totally gets creating digital content.
I think what you talked about there is really the important change in Elite Daily that I've noticed is that in the beginning, it was just like, these are the 15 people that work here, so they're going to be on the air, or they're going to be the voice or the writer, or they're going to be in charge of the hiring, even if that's something that they are 100% not qualified to do. And then as time has gone on, it seems like the people in the video are either actors or more polished on camera. The people producing the videos are actually producers. The directors are directors, you know, so everything just looks cleaner. It feels more polished. It is cleaner. It has a much more focused identity. And it's not like it doesn't feel like it's a tacky knockoff of like Bro Bible anymore. It feels like it has its own lane, for lack of a better term. But anyway, thank you so much for taking some time. We have the last segment here that we'll wrap up with, which is I always like to, after I'm done talking with someone for about 45 minutes, and I've asked them everything about them, I like to, like a job interview, sort of flip it on its head and say, all right, you know, when you're on a job interview and then you've been basically so attentive for 45 minutes and then they say to you, do you have any questions for me? And then you start sweating on the inside of your body because you have nothing planned because everything's been answered. So with that in mind, I hope that it is air conditioned where you are, because I will turn the table over to you. If you have any questions for me, I'll answer one question and then we'll wrap up.
All right. One question, Scott Spinelli. What's the next book you're working on? Is there any other books in the works? What's next for you?
Actually, that's a fantastic question, because the next book is actually the reason why this is the last quote-unquote episode of the season. We've done 15 of these, and I need to take some time. This is actually taking more time out of my life than I thought it would. You know, I mean, it's only like once a week, but it's, as you know, as you were describing, that hustle of creating content. I mean, this is not the same. Obviously, it's not video, but it still takes time. It's not something that you can just whip through. And so as a result, I am finishing this first draft of this novel that I'm finishing up now. And the basic idea of it is it's the working title I had for it is called Searching for Allie. The name Allie, though, being sort of in parentheses, like it could be anybody. This male perspective of a guy who is finally single, and the first girl that he falls in love with turns out to be engaged. And so he then goes on this journey to figure out what it is that he actually wants, you know, from a relationship, even though he has no idea because he's been out of the game for so long. And I just have always found, I don't know about you, how much do you read books, or are you more of an online reader?
I mean, naturally, I'm more of an online reader because I just spend most of my day there. But when I get to go on, you know, the occasional vacation, I definitely like reading. But I find I read more like biographies than nonfiction. I read more nonfiction than fiction, but not that I'm against a good fiction book.
Yeah, no, I've noticed that for whatever reason, these sort of stories are male stories of romance are either like categorized like Tucker, what's his name, Tucker. Or there's sort of some sort of like bromance, you know, Seth Rogen type story, as opposed to just, you know, I don't think I fit into either of those categories. I'm sort of just a normal guy who's trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And that's the only unfortunate part is that I write books for the one demographic of people that don't read. So that's a whole nother story.
that's a fair point. Though, you know, you can flip it for, you know, girls should be interested in the male perspective. So, I mean, you could definitely do it that way. And also, listen, when this book is done, I mean, you should consider doing some more contributing writing for the site and trying to, you know, put articles up there that if they generate enough traffic and, you know, you can hyperlink back to your book. You should definitely look into it.
I would love to. I've always wanted to get back involved. I remember the people that I was dealing with in the beginning And I sent you some very frustrated messages about this. I know.
That's so long ago. It's funny because I know. I was dealing with all the same frustrations too. I mean, I'm sure you know. I would message you back and being like, "Yeah, screw these guys." But I mean, it is such a different world than it was then. So yeah, I wouldn't be anything that happened 3 years ago that discouraged you. I mean, it's a totally different ball game today.
All right, man. Well, listen. Well, maybe in the next month or week or so, I'll reach out. We'll see what we can do. Thanks so much for taking the time, my man. I really appreciate it.
No, for sure. It was a lot of fun, and I'm honored to be the season finale. Wow, that's pretty big.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, right? I mean, I think as far as I didn't mean it as a sort of a you truly are the you were joking before, like you've had some bad guests. You're the first comedian I've had on, so that explains why you're the funniest. But
now I feel a lot less good about it now. Great, thanks.
But the truth is that, and I wouldn't just put this out there. What I find impressive about you comedically is that you have, you're not just a one trick pony. You know, you don't have just this. I've been convinced of that more and more over the years, where I've been following what you've been doing and putting out there and been a part of. And even if you didn't necessarily write it, obviously you're overseeing a team of people, and it has to pass through your filter. And that is most what I'm sort of excited by what you produce, is that it's not just one type of thing anymore. It's all over the place. I mean, we didn't talk about this during the episode, obviously, and we don't have time now, but the sort of the musical parodies, the Nassau County State of Mind, the stuff you're doing now with Elite Daily, the sort of more sexual jokes that you were doing when you were younger. I've liked all of it, but I like that you are now, at least it seems to me, like you've done, you have the full variety of complement of things that you can do, so. Anyway.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm significantly less funny now, because now I have to wear a serious hat and manage people, but ultimately creating content, whether, like I said, it makes people laugh, or it makes people cry, or it makes people, you know, frustrated. I think, to me, like, I've fallen more in love with just creating emotions out of people through content than necessarily having it to be laughter. I still love comedy. You know, it's still close to my heart, but ultimately, you know, doing something like fantastic, like that Flint documentary, you know, I still get a great deal of satisfaction out of that as well.
All right, Tyler, thanks for taking the time, my man.
All right, sounds good, man. Have a good one, dude.
All right, everybody, that was Tyler Gilden. Really funny dude, and had some good stuff to say about how to make it, or the various ways you can make it in the entertainment and comedy field. You can find him at Tyler Gilden on Twitter, and obviously all over Elite Daily's website, in charge of a lot of the video content that goes on there. Like I said at the top, this is our last episode for the season. We'll be back in about 3 to 4 months with a bunch of really great guests I have lined up, and hopefully some more that I will continue to line up. You can follow me at Spinelli_Scott. And like I said, hopefully we'll be taking the next 3 or 4 months to finish this first draft of the book I'm working on, and additionally some other writing projects, including that top 250 feelings that I've sort of put on the back burner for a long time. Hopefully that'll be up and running again fairly shortly. So once again, thank you so much to everybody for listening and leaving comments and, you know, rating and reviewing and sharing with your friends and all that stuff. Much appreciated, and we will see you in a few months.